Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up.
What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ
106.5 FM
Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and
1050
AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren, Mr. John Copenhaver. How are you doing?
I am going nuts these days. I'm trying to finish up my novel by the end of the month, and it's going, but it's just, I've never written so many words in such a short amount of time.
Yeah, you're so shy and quiet all the time.
I am. I'm very reserved.
I've seen all these shows you've been at. Don't give me that.
Well, yeah, I have been. I've been doing that. I've been going to different festivals and, Tucson and Saints and Sinners in New Orleans. That was kind of a lot, pretty busy March for me, but, and it was lovely. But unfortunately, when you're doing that stuff, you can't get a lot of writing done. At least, I shouldn't speak for everyone, but I certainly.
Well, no.
Do not get a lot of writing done in this.
Well, especially when you're laying on the middle of the table.
Oh, yeah, because I'm such a party animal, Copenhaver here.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm like in bed by 9, Copenhaver.
Yeah, I know that feeling. Yeah. Past my bedtime at 9, yeah. Getting old. Well, today we have got a writer, and his new book, which is out now, is called Sunset Empire, and it's a Morris Baker novel. So the author is with us, Mr. Josh Weiss. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, guys. Real honor to be here. I just want to quickly say that, as soon as I saw the name of this program, I had no notes. I was like, I want to be on this. It's called House of Mystery. I'm sold. So. Be here.
I thought you said as soon as you hear the name, you're like, are you kidding? Tell the agent, what are you doing? You know, I don't want to be in this.
What's the mystery?
Yeah, these bad shows. God, what?
No.
You know, two listeners and a bad host.
No, it's really great to be here, guys. And it's just so great to be on the circuit again for my new book.
Yeah. Do you like that sort of thing? Do you like being on the tour? You know, like John over there, he's at all the shows and he's, you know, hobnobbing with all the writers and stuff. Do you like doing book shows and book tours and all that sort of stuff, book signings?
Yeah, I mean, I have a love-hate relationship because I'm so bad at public speaking and just speaking in general. That's why I write. But it's just fun to, you know, talk to like-minded individuals and really promote the book. And, you know, book signings, my friends and family come, and it's like a big party, so... I can't complain about that. You know, it's a little bit of speaking and then I'm signing and kind of shooting the breeze with people. So that's nice.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always good to meet people and stuff. Have you been, has the new climate of the world, you know, like with social media and all the platforms and all that stuff, have you adapted to that easily as in selling books like Facebook and Twitter and TikTok and all that?
Yeah, I mean, like I grew up in the pre-social media age, so I've kind of come up with it and I've had to adapt with it. But you know, it is. I think it's again a double-edged sword, just because there's so much noise out there. You're kind of shouting into the void a little bit, especially if you're not, you know, I'm not a Stephen King or a James Patterson or something like that. So I don't hold as much clout as those other writers. So it sometimes can be a little difficult to kind of carve out your own niche online. But, it's fun, when you're interacting with people again online. It's a little different than being in person, obviously. But I feel like that's not a very good answer. But, yeah, it has its ups and downs.
Stephen King. Now, people keep mentioning him, and I don't know who he is. I'm going to have to. I can't find him anywhere. I don't know.
Oh, you need to get Stephen King on the show.
Yeah, that'd but he's too awesome. Small. You know, I like to have someone at least has had a book out. Right? Yeah. Something. You know, even if they've got, you know, independent, self-published, one book only type thing. At least there's something to talk about. I don't know what I talk to this guy about, you know. Maybe there's something. You're writing this book. Is this where did the writing start for you? Because I get a feeling this isn't really your first book. So how did you get into writing?
I've been writing for as long as I can remember. I mean, in third grade, I think, is really when I began to realize I wanted to do this. Even recreationally, we would just do like journal entries in the mornings, as soon as class started, and we could write about our lives or anything. I mean, I came in one day, I'd seen Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, and I just wrote down a synopsis of the plot because I was so enthralled with that film, and felt the need to explain to my teacher that I was plagiarizing a film and not writing about something original. But, you know, it's just, I've always loved to read. I've always loved to write. And I never really thought I could make a career out of it. I kind of just fell into, I mean, I do entertainment journalism now and written two books now. So I kind of just fell into it. I never thought I could actually make a profession out of this. So it really goes back to just loving to read, loving to write, writing short stories. You know, I wasn't the coolest kid in growing up. So writing was kind of a way to be the hero of my own story and kind of feel cool about myself. So, just a combination of all those things. And then, you know, with this Morris Baker series, I started a bunch of books in high school. None of them got finished. And then in college, I finally just sat down and said, I'm going to write this noir inspired alternate crime thriller set during the Cold War in a universe where Joseph McCarthy is president. And this one actually took root and actually got finished. Which was kind of surprising. So, and here we are now, two books later, which is very exciting.
Yeah, I noticed you're kind of historical fiction here. You're kind of taking these times in the past, like, you know, put Joseph McCarthy as president. So you've kind of changed what really happened and you're running with it. What makes you go that way? Like, what made you follow that type of a storyline?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And just going back to my upbringing, I grew up Jewish. My grandfather was a Holocaust survivor. So kind of looking back at the past was always something, you know, I learned about at home, at school, hearing about my grandfather's story of survival during the war from his son, my father. So it's just something that I've always been fascinated with, just kind of like the way history works, how these little changes, you know, almost, and in the first book I talk about kind of the butterfly effect, how these little fluctuations can make these huge changes. And that really fascinates me. And I love reading alternate history. I mean, I think Fatherland by Robert Harris is genius. It's one of my favorite books. And I really wanted to write something in that vein. So again, just going back to my father, you know, I grew up, our home library, you know, was Jewish Hebrew texts on one side and secular texts on the other. And just every book you can imagine on World War II. And my friends would come over and make jokes that there had to be a swastika on like every other book in the shelf because my father was reading all these World War II histories. So it's just something I've just kind of, you know, kind of through osmosis growing up, something I've been fascinated with, and just hearing those stories about my grandfather. I didn't know him that well, but I started to build this character in my head and tried to understand, you know, why was he not super loving to me when I was a kid before he died? You know, why was he so emotionally distant and cold? So this was kind of a way to kind of get in touch with a grandfather I didn't really know and try to understand how he had gone through these horrors during the Holocaust and how a person could come out the other side whole. And, you know, my conclusion was they wouldn't. They'd be broken, they'd be distant, and they'd be bitter. So that was kind of the genesis of the character and the historical setting.
I'm really interested in Joseph McCarthy too. In fact, I'm writing a historical novel set during the 1950s, and I've always been kind of fascinated with him. I think went back to my high school. I think I read a paper on him my senior year of high school. You know, what drew you to McCarthy and then give him the presidency? I mean, why that choice, sort of in kind of, I guess, the many choices you can make in creating an alternate history.
Mm-hmm. Well, the most basic bit of reasoning was that I had not seen this done before. I had not, not to say it hasn't been written, but I had not read any books or stories about McCarthy becoming president. So that just seemed kind of like unmined territory to start with. And then once I decided, because I had been thinking about wanting to write my grandfather's story, but I didn't know enough to write like a biography or a work of nonfiction. So I kind of had that simmering. And then I saw, I've said this before, but I had seen the original Manchurian Candidate and wanted to write a Cold War mystery thriller in that vein. And then it just kind of, I married, you know, chocolate and peanut butter, just the ideas kind of married. And once I decided to have this homicide detective who was also a Holocaust survivor, it just made sense to place him in a context. He had just come out of World War II and the Holocaust. And now he came to America. He wants to start fresh in the quote unquote land of opportunity and everybody's equal. But he's learning now that with McCarthy's president, every history is repeating itself. People are being scapegoated. You know, anyone associated with communism is disappearing or being persecuted simply because their political beliefs are different or people are just pointing fingers to get ahead in life. So I just thought that was really interesting to explore kind of this character seeing history repeat itself.
Did you bring in that nasty woman, Hedda Hopper?
There is a little reference to her in the first book, if you're paying attention, a little Easter egg, a mention of her and Marilyn Monroe.
And Walter Winchell, too. He was a real McCarthy supporter there towards the end.
Yeah, and it's interesting just during the research process and even while you're writing, just kind of learning little tidbits and working those in where you can, you know, like you just said, Walter Winchell, who was a big kind of Red Scare fanatic as well. So kind of just making him the propagandist almost, you know, almost like the Goebbels of this administration just seemed like the right fit.
Yeah, it's crazy. I when I learned about Hedda, homosexuals were automatic communists, you know, and some of her yeah. theories were, she was just a crazy woman. But, you know, what goes around comes around because we're kind of, it's come back again lately.
Right. And that's something that just kind of fascinates me again about history is how we just continue to go through these cycles and we never learn from our past mistakes. It's just kind of how we are. I mean, it seems like evil is just in our DNA almost, which is just very sad. And so that kind of that bit of human nature, how we just always are looking to point fingers and blame others for whatever problem comes along and that snowballs into horrific actions. I think that's, you know, it's obviously it's set in the 50s, but it's timeless, a timeless kind of motif.
Well, you know, it's funny because I think what it is just like, so a generation now has no idea what it was like to be around in the 60s or the 50s because it's out of touch. And I guess there's just not enough information in schools at the time to teach you or something. I don't know. I sound like an old guy. But how do you, as a writer, how do you get your head into the space where you can actually write from a perspective of your characters, such as, you know, Morris Baker, you know, the detective Holocaust survivor, because of course it's all pre you too as well, so you didn't live it. How do you get into that headspace where you can actually write that character?
Yeah, I mean, it's another great question. And I think it's all about kind of finding your way in through something that relates back to you, I guess. And as much as this character is based on my grandfather and, you know, Sam Spade and Philip Marlowe and Jake Giddies and all those great pulp hard-boiled heroes, his struggles with faith and belief are really kind of reflective of my own. Just going back to what I was just saying about all the evil in the world in the past and now, you know, how can you believe in a higher power when there is so much wickedness in the world? And that was kind of just another way for me to kind of work through not only not knowing my grandfather, but also just, you know, confronting as an adult how upside down the world can be sometimes. And I just think, you know, if it were me who had gone through 3 concentration camps and a death march and losing my entire family, I would be bitter. I would not want to be part of the world. I kind of want to shut myself away. And I think that is the aspect, character trait of Morris Baker that I relate to the most. And that was kind of the way in, just kind of reflecting, kind of working through this was almost like a therapy session, I guess you could say, writing this character, because it allowed me to cathartically work through these feelings.
Now, on the new book, Sunset Empire, you get into the Korean-American War. How did you handle that? Like, how do you handle that? Like, are you trying to make, I wonder, are you trying to make a statement about the actual war that raged on, or were you, is it something different?
You know, it's, there's an interesting thing. When before I sold the book, my agent kind of made an interesting suggestion saying, you know, why not have things be different? Obviously, this is a alternate reality, but why not have things happen as they did in our world, just in different circumstances, different contexts, and later than they did in our world? And so I kind of took that to heart. And in this world, the point of divergence is that the Korean War has raged on. It's kind of the Vietnam of this world. And that's what allowed McCarthy to stay in power and become president, is that he played on that fear, promising to end the war, and he hasn't. So it really was just, I mentioned it in the first book briefly, but I wanted to really dive in into this book, especially since this book really gets into the influences that kind of drove me to write the first book, which was that original Manchurian Candidate film. And it kind of plays around with those Cold War ideas. I don't want to give too much away, but, you know, it is, like I say, kind of a reflection of the Vietnam War. And I guess you could also say, you know, the U.S. involvement in the Middle East as well. So I never set out to write an allegory about the state of the world. I think it just kind of happened accidentally. But it just, again, goes back to, we just, history is just, it rhymes. I forget, was it Mark Twain who said, I forget what the quote is, but something about history rhyming. And so, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I didn't set out to make like a bold political statement, but it just kind of happened as I was writing. Things were mirroring what I was writing in the book. So I think it plays nicely in with that theme of just cycles and humanity leaning into its worst tendencies.
And you made President Richard Nixon, or Vice President Richard Nixon, a vice president again?
Yeah.
The nerve.
Well, we'll see. He plays a bigger role in this book, in the new book. But I thought, you know, he's weaselly enough, even in this reality, he got the vice presidency.
What's so interesting about this time period, though? I mean, it is fascinating to do like a reimagining of it historically, but so many of the things that happened in the 1950s, you can trace back to what's going on now. You know, I mean, I feel like the seeds were there, right? So you could imagine them going lots of different ways, you know, during that time period. You know, I don't know if that you include this in the books at all. I'm very focused on the Lavender Scare, which sort of was a sub category of the Red Scare, and, you know, that affected gays and lesbians were booted out of various government agencies, like the State Department stuff, because like you were saying, Al, they were all conflated with communism. But it was a tool. I mean, it was like, obviously, you know, Joseph McCarthy, you know, breeding a group of people to hate and to be suspicious of to then gain power, right? And it's just, you know, I don't think we're done with these issues. I mean, do you think a lot when you're writing your books, are you thinking about them in terms of how they might sort of spark or, land on like contemporary political issues or that sort of thing? I mean, I know you're probably not engaging directly, but are you hoping for that resonance?
For sure. I mean, I don't think I go in again wanting to kind of touch on those things, just because it might become dated if I try to make some sort of statement. I think it kind of comes naturally with what's going on in the world. But, you know, the fact that the main character is a Holocaust survivor, his experiences are rooted in that age-old bigotry of just pointing at the other, you know, like you're saying, riling up people to hate a specific group of people just because they act differently or they behave differently or they look differently. Just, you know, the honing in on the minutiae of what people do and saying that's wrong because, and they're evil because they don't act like us, they don't look like us. So I think the fact that this character is Jewish Holocaust survivor from Europe, his kind of plight is applicable to just those wider themes of xenophobia and baseless bigotry and blind hatred and all those nasty things that unfortunately we still tend to do as a species.
So are you going to continue this series? Is this going to be like a long running series? Do you think you're going to kind of keep moving it through, or are you going to go somewhere else?
You know, I have an idea for a third one. I'd love to start writing it. You know, Scott, talking to my agent now, if you're listening, let's get the wheels moving. I have an idea for a third one. I have 50 pages of other ideas that I'd love to do. You know, if it's something different and then I come back to this, remains to be seen. I have dozens and dozens of ideas that I'd love to explore. So it really just depends on, what my agent and I settle on next. But the wheels are starting to turn slowly but surely. You guys know publishing is a very slow business. So, I'm just promoting this new book. I'd love to continue Morris Baker in whatever form that may take. So we'll see. Fingers crossed.
Yeah, it's such an interesting – there's so much going on in that time period. And I'll tell you, you know, it must have been crazy for someone, let's say, at our age now or your age now, when you kind of go – if you were back in those times, if you were 50 in the late 50s or the early 60s, I wonder if you would have thought the world was ending.
It's a good point, especially because you have the whole Cold War nuclear annihilation thing. I often wonder, like, how prevalent was that in people in the 50s, you know, around that time with duck and cover and the whole Cuban Missile Crisis in the early 60s? Like, how... I mean, I guess you're having it explored in great shows like The Twilight Zone and stuff like that. So I guess, obviously the fear was there, but I'm curious, like the average person, did they think that the world was going to be erased at any time?
Well, it had to have, you know, because even me as a kid growing up in the 60s, you know, they had the bomb shelters and we had just like you had fire practices, you know, where the alarm would go on and everybody would have to go outside for a fire alarm. There's also the bomb raid alarms too, and everybody would have to go down into the basement of the school. That's just in the 60s. So I could imagine someone older, someone around in the 50s, if you grow up with that, it's got to have an effect.
Yeah.
I, you know, it's interesting. The more I, you know, that time period, you think about it, there's kind of a doubleness, I think, that happens a lot there. Like, the 50s were just such a time where people were like, everything had a sort of, polished veneer to it, right? And then there, all this dark stuff was going on underneath the surface. Like, and I think a lot of people are like, you know, just not thinking about it or not consciously thinking about it. But it's all these issues, like social justice issues to, you know, world-ending nuclear annihilation. We're definitely all happening in the 50s, but then you pick up magazines and stuff and you look at some of the art that was created then. And some of it is really kind of, you know, it's very light and very, you know, shiny. So it's just such a weird time period.
Yeah. Leave It to Beaver on TV. Yeah. And then yet you're shooting your president.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's such a, you know, they had a polish. This is what we are, but it's not really who they were.
Yeah. It goes back to what we were talking about why this particular time period, and John just encapsulated it perfectly. Like there was this whole, you know, gee whiz, idealism, if that is a word, to the whole decade time period. But, you know, you had anti-Semitism, homophobia, racism. This just, once you peel back the veneer, as you said, there was all these societal problems and the threat of nuclear annihilation. And that really intrigued me, of exploring this. You know, the post-war economy is booming, everything's great. And we see that on television, but everything in society was not that great, both at home and geopolitically with Russia and the proxy wars and everything related to the Cold War. And I think that was interesting, and that's why I wanted to set it in Los Angeles, not only because it's so inexplicably tied with the genre, but because you have this sunny city, you know, known for glamour, this facade. And then when you peel it back, there is this kind of grimy, gritty underbelly. So I thought that was a great parallel to the time period.
Yeah, and then you had Elvis come out and shake his hips on TV. Disgusting. You see, rock and roll wrecked it all, didn't it? You know, then the other thing, you also bring back the internment camps, and that's another touchy subject as well. I can't believe how many people, younger people, didn't realize there was such a thing.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy just to think about how we were fighting the Nazis, how they were doing, putting people in camps because they were different, torturing them and depriving them of their humanity. And the United States was doing that at the very same time. Their troops were fighting for democracy and freedom. So that dichotomy that just kind of, there's a dissonance of how you could, you know, do something like that when you're fighting against that very practice. So it is crazy. And unfortunately, sometimes an obscure bit of history that is not brought up.
Yeah, well, it feels like to me, I don't know if you agree, Josh, that, you know, there's a real usefulness in writing historical fiction, whether it's, you know, you're trying to set it in the against the actual incidents or imagine, you know, the what ifs. Like, it feels like a good, I don't know if you agree with this, but it feels like a good way of sort of exploring some of these histories that have been, you know, in a lot of ways that haven't been taught or haven't been communicated. You know, I was just listening to a podcast called Ultra about the sort of Nazi party post-World War II in the U.S. And like, that's crazy. And I knew about it to a certain degree, you know, as an adult, but I'd never as a, you know, certainly through school, did we ever talk about the fact that in the 1930s, there was a, you know, a group of people in the U.S. trying to, you know, promote fascism. And so it's just, I think, I don't know, I think there's sort of a uniqueness, and maybe it's just because I write it, but to historical fiction, that it can kind of help pull that stuff up from the, you know, from the past and maybe look at it differently.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Like you say, just either, you know, some people, it either becomes obscure or people try to downplay it, the importance of it. And I think it ties back into just the genre itself. I mean, speculative fiction is sort of, you know, I think it's like a subset of science fiction. And that genre is always ripe for exploring harsher subjects and topics that people might not be so inclined to swallow if it were just kind of give it to them straight. You know, it is kind of that sugar that helps the medicine go down. And that's why I love the original Twilight Zone so much, because it explored those pressing, it put a mirror up to society through that lens of sci-fi and fantasy. And we're still talking about it to this day. So I think it's great to not only boost, like you're saying, those kind of little, again, I guess more obscure bits of history or things that people downplay or don't think are important to mention to us as we're growing up, while also, you know, giving them themes and lessons through this kind of, I'm not going to say fun story, but this genre of speculative fiction.
Well, when each time you go through the process of doing one of these books, and this is the second one you've published, how has it changed you?
It's changed my bank account for sure. You know, I think it just kind of made me, I'd say the process just made me a little more disciplined as a writer. I mean, I write several articles a day for my day job. Kind of that, my day job mixed with writing books, I think I'm a little bit more disciplined. Okay, this needs to get done. I mean, this is kind of the more nuts and bolts of it, but just setting yourself a deadline and a quota to hit, and hitting that quota and being self-disciplined when you're not, you know, this is not a 9-to-5 where you have to fill out a certain amount of spreadsheets or input numbers or whatever. This is, you're beholden really to yourself, and you have to keep yourself in line. So I'd say it just made me more disciplined. I mean, when I'm writing a book, I try to hit 1,000 words a day, and I'm writing every day, even if I'm working. So it's just about keeping yourself focused and disciplined. And I think it helped me a little bit better. I mean, I'm still addicted to my phone and social media. I won't lie about that. But, you know, just when the chips are down, I think I'm good at kind of focusing on what needs to get done as a writer.
What do you hope people get out of the book then? At the end of it, like someone picks up Sunset Empire and reads it and that, what is it you hope they take away?
That's a great question. I hope they like Morris Baker as a character. I mean, I know I've seen people say they find him detestable, which is fair. I mean, he's not a lovable, cuddly guy. He's prickly for sure, but he is that kind of classic noir hero. He's very nihilist, and he is based on my grandfather, who was not a very loving individual, at least to me. So, I guess I'm just talking to the haters now, but, you know, just that they find this world interesting. I mean, personally, when I read this genre, I just love the little asides to the bigger world and how it deviates. And I've had people, you know, say, I love this mention of this treatment of this historical figure, or this mention of that. So, you know, just the, I think if they think the world building is interesting and that the character is compelling, I think I've done my job.
Yeah, it's interesting. Are you keeping track by, do you have some sort of a Bible or some sort of a way of keeping track of your character or characters throughout the series then?
Not at present. I mean, it's only two books, so but if it does become this bigger thing, I think that would be, actually, I hadn't even thought of that, so thank you.
Yeah, get on it, because it's the worst mistake.
Yeah.
It's the worst thing that happens is you, all of a sudden you start doing book three and four, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, what did he do? You know, and you start thinking about things, and, because people, readers and that are the best at pointing out anything you've made a mistake on. They love
that. Phenomenal point. And it's funny because, you know, you become so tied up in it. You're so close to it that you can't see the flaws in it if there are, you know, continuity issues. And that happened with me on the first book. Like, there was a huge plot hole that I had to go back and fix late in the process. And I had to do a whole flow chart in my notebook just to figure it out, hold all the pieces in my head. So having a Bible about this world is a great idea. If you're writing a book now and you're an author, do that. Don't make my mistakes.
Yeah. I think we interviewed someone else who had, like, they were on their 17th book or something on that. And they said the worst mistake they ever made was not having that, that sort of outline or Bible or reference book. And, it caused a lot of grief. So yeah, it's get on it. Cause you're only done two and you're going on three. So I would get on it now. That's an order.
Yeah, it's.
We also interviewed someone who had someone keeping a Bible for them.
Yeah,
it would be a career goal for me.
Yeah,
actually, a good idea. Have a objective observer almost to kind of keep track of things for you.
Goodness, that would make so much easier. Someone step in, being no, that's not what.
Yeah, no, you can't do that. No, he didn't have blue eyes. No. Like, you know, it's kind of crazy, but there's little things. There's a lot of details that go into a book, and you kind of go through it. And I don't know about you, but when I'm finished a book, a lot of times you just sort of want to forget it and move on.
Yeah.
For sure. You know, and so it's hard to kind of keep all the details in there, you know?
Yeah. Even just, yeah, like little character bios, because I, now that you say it, like just character, like the color of someone's eyes. Yeah. It's like, you have to go back and be like, what does his hair look like? What color are his eyes? You know, that sort of. The minutiae.
Exactly. Yeah, and it depends on how deep you get. You know, what do they like to eat? What don't they like to eat? Who, you know, just the little characteristics that you put into it to have the reader understand who that person is. And you don't want to screw up, because they love pointing out mistakes. Oh, and that's another thing. So when you research too on the timing and all that stuff, you have to be fairly confident in your details. I know you change it because, you know, you're doing this kind of, you know, alternative way of things happening, but it's still the key things have got to be what they were, I guess.
Yeah. And that's really the difficulty of it is kind of figuring out that balance between how accurate are you to the time period and the people. And at what point are you able to get creative and diverge and take poetic license? And it's always, you know, if you get too much in the weeds, I think you can kind of get in your own head. And if you let that take over, you're going to start writing nonfiction. So it really is a balance. And just yesterday, I had a friend who's reading the first book ask me, you know, did this term exist in the 50s? And I said, you know, let's just chalk it up to it being an alternate reality. And one of the characters, going back to what you're saying about character traits, I mean, Morris Baker loves to drink peach schnapps, which were technically not invented till the 80s, as a mixologist friend pointed out to me. And I still love it as a character trait. I think peach schnapps are foul and nobody should drink them straight, but it's just, it's such a fun thing, quirk for this character to have. But, you know, at some point you just have to chalk up the inaccuracies and anachronisms and say, this is a different universe and reality and things are different.
I'll say.
Yeah, I think I'll definitely steer clear of peach schnapps.
Yeah, it's good as a mixer, but never drink it by itself.
Heartburn at this age, I'm telling you. Just the thought of it. But so what's next for you? What's next for Josh? What's he going to do?
Well, I mean, just I'm still pitching book three, whatever, if that's a third Morris Baker or something different. Still ironing out the details on that. Hopefully there's more exciting news. Right now, just working. And I'm going to be in Italy later this month. I don't know when this interview's coming out. If anyone's in Italy, hit me up. Just still doing entertainment articles, interviewing cool people like you guys do. So life is good, I have to say.
Do you take into account sensitivity? You're dealing with such, they're subject that aren't always, you know, easy to deal with, and that. So are you cautious of, or conscious, let's say, of how you write, let's say, the violence or the hate or the sex in the book?
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, I'm writing about all these different characters and people from all these different walks of life. So I'm not going to claim that I know how to write from all these different perspectives. But I think having, you know, a supportive editor and people, family and friends or whoever it may be who are willing to read the manuscript and say, you know, this might be too much. This is too extreme. This word, maybe change it with this. This is not the right description. So it is, that's definitely always, you know, I'm always being sensitive and wary of what I'm writing, but also making sure that you have that outside observer who can give you a different perspective and, you know, not just say, you know, huff and say, I know best about all these different things, because you don't, and nobody does. So it's really about being sensitive and also giving it to other people so they can give you feedback and helping it be the best that it can be.
So you've mentioned two films in the interview so far. I want to know more about why you're attracted to them. One was The Temple of Doom, right, when you were young. I'm a huge indie fan. Of course, there's the next one coming out this summer, I guess. And then, The Manchurian Candidate, you mentioned several times, which I get is very connected to this time period. Also a great movie. And Angela Lansbury, particularly, like one of my favorite villains of all time in that film. But I'm just curious, like, what do you get a lot of inspiration from other films, or is it particularly those? Or
yeah, I just love. I've always loved movies as much as I love reading and writing. So I try to write, I hope, as cinematically as possible for the reader. I mean, I know there's I'm pretty sure when Scorsese wrote Goodfellas, he wrote the songs, the needle drops right into the script. And there's a ton of those in my books, just references to the songs and the culture to kind of place the reader there, even though it is a different time period or a different universe, I should say. But, you know, like you said, Indiana Jones, I'm a huge Indiana Jones fan, cannot wait for Dial of Destiny, especially since it's Indy fighting Nazis who were brought here as part of Operation Paperclip, which is big in my books. I just love characters that fight Nazis. What can I say? Just kind of love that pulp, the pulpiness of it. And definitely Indy is definitely part of Morris Baker's DNA, I would say. And The Manchurian Candidate and just other paranoia thrillers of the Cold War, The Parallax View, 3 Days of the Condor, those types of films. I just love conspiracy thrillers. I'm not sure why. I mean, the conspiracy thrillers tie in so well with noir fiction, which also deal with conspiracies a lot of times. I just love the idea of a ordinary individual stumbling upon something bigger than themselves. It just kind of, again, goes back to I was a nerd growing up. I wasn't going on a lot of dates. I was just imagining myself like Indiana Jones as a suave adventurer. So I guess that's where it comes from, just kind of that wish fulfillment aspect of it.
Yeah, there's something definitely when you're, I don't know if this is true for all writers, but it certainly was true for me, where as a kid, you're usually reserved, spending a lot of time, you know, by yourself, imagining, and you'd always start having these scenarios where suddenly like something really unexpected would enter, you know, some adventure would fall in your lap, like it always does in the movies. There's something about that scenario, which I, as a consumer of stories, but also as a writer is very interesting. Like the average folk, average person, stumbling on an adventure. And it's actually something kind of noir about it too, but I haven't figured that out exactly what it is about that. But maybe it's just someone being isolated. That's very noir. But do you have favorite noir authors that you're kind of go to again and again? I think you mentioned, you know, sort of the classic Chandler, and especially with LA and stuff.
Yeah, you have Chandler, Hammett. I mean, I think most of my reference for noir comes from films. So Chinatown, and I love, and Blade Runner, I mean, Who Framed Roger Rabbit. I know these are neo-noirs that kind of mix up the genre, but I really like that because it takes that classic formula of the, you know, Golden Age Hollywood and really kind of spices it up. So I recently watched Minority Report, which is also in that style, and just, I love to see how noir is applied to these different genres. And I think that's really, really my reference for that.
Yeah, there's all this sort of conversation about noir. Is it a genre? Is it a kind of a look and feel of a film? Or is it sort of a thematic, you know, thread? I mean, do you have any opinions about that? I'm just curious out of nowhere.
Interesting. I mean, I think it's all encompassing, I would say. It's the look of a film, the themes, the characters. I mean, the settings. I mean, I almost set this Morris Baker's universe in New York, but then I was like, no, it has to be in Los Angeles. It's such a staple of the genre. So I'd say it's not something that can, I guess, you can't really quantify. It is the look of a film. It is the themes of a story. It is the characters who inhabit it. I'm gonna have to go with that more general answer. I guess it doesn't really settle the debate, but.
No, well, it's just fun to think about, right? It's,
yeah.
This is the English teacher in me coming out where I'm like, okay, let's try to, pick a term and see if it fits, and knowing that nothing ever fits easily. So, but yeah.
Yeah, the world is you know, gray. It's not a black and white place, even though those old films were in black and white. But everything's up to interpretation.
So you talked about social media and you've adapted. So where do people find Josh? Do you have like a website? Do you have which social media platforms can they connect up with you?
Fans, if I have any, can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Joshua H. Weiss. That's WEISS. Sometimes people ask if it's one S or two. It's two. I do have a website that needs to be updated. So find me on those social media platforms.
And you're not on TikTok?
I am on TikTok. I don't make a ton of content. I do a lot of scrolling through TikTok. A lot of people tell me I should get involved with BookTok. But that is actually one platform I'm still getting used to. I'm feeling my age a little bit with TikTok.
Well, just get on there and dance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With my book in the background.
Yeah. Get your dog out there and then you guys just jump around and then your dog reads your book or something. And then there you go.
Should. Yeah. He's adorable. So I feel like he'd drive the clicks.
Oh yeah, of course. If you have a
cute
dog,
animal pictures, always a win.
Yeah. Dogs are number one, you know, bring your animal into it and then kind of put the book in there. Well, I appreciate you being on the show. Now, of course, the book we're talking about is your new book called Sunset Empire. And the guest has been the author of that book. And look for many more. So, Mr. Josh Weiss, thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, guys. This was awesome.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.